On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
Elvis rejected it, you know. Not Elvis Presley, Elvis Costello. Jem Finer and Shane McGowan's masterpiece, Fairy Tale of New York, was kind of fortunate to ever make it into the recording booth because along the way it lost its original female vocalist and some of the record label weren't sure whether it was worth putting out because they had some doubts about the quality of the song. But it's a song which, as we know, is packed full of historical reference. It has almost a theatrical quality that reveals a lot about the influences of the band. And the very fact that it's been voted not just Ireland's favourite Christmas song, but also the UK's Christmas song, is testament to a band that belonged in equal parts to both parts of the islands. And Donald Fallon is here with us to go through the history of the Fairy Tale. Donald, fair to say that the Pogues might be well adored now for the likes of this and other works, but it wasn't always so.
What I like about the Pogues, people often think about the Pogues as an Irish band, and they're not. They're fundamentally a London Irish band. So it's the story of one small island and one very, very big city, and how these things have kind of intersected in sometimes surprising ways. And the Pogues, you know, they were a Marmite band. They very much divided opinion. The journalist and the political activist Eamon McCann, he described them as a band who gave defiant and poetic expression to a community which had never felt able to proclaim itself. Not everyone adored them, you know, from the words of Tommy Makem. Tommy Makem, of course, of Makem and the Clancy Brothers. Mm. He said that the Pogues were the greatest disaster ever to hit Irish music. So can both of those things be true? An incredibly divisive band in their day, but a band I and many, many people have a great affection for.
And this is it. And they're part of the story of another city entirely and really the identity of what you might call the London diaspora.
Yeah, and in a shameless plug, I would draw attention to a really excellent social media page run by a friend of mine, Koundé London, on Instagram.
What a great name.
And it draws attention to the kind of sights of Irish history in London, which mostly are kind of fading memories of the past. Now, some of them remain. In recent weeks, we talked about Hans Place on this
yes,
lot.
And where the treaty delegations
lodged. But a lot of what John looks at on that page, the dance halls, the Irish centres, the Greasy Spoons, all of that is pretty much a memory now. You know, and companies like Murphy's Construction and the house builders, Wimpy. The joke being that Wimpy stood for "We import more patties every year."
Very good.
In some ways, the most obvious representation of Irish graft in London, but the Pogues had enormous cultural significance. And Martin McDonagh, the director, he recounts that they were amongst the first people who helped define what you could be as a second-generation Irish person in this country, by which, of course, he meant England.
Is that the account that you mentioned before? I think, did you tell me that there was, and we talked about this when we were talking about the Mayo Curse a couple of months ago, that there's a pub in Ealing that has like a giant Mayo crest painted on the side?
It's in Camden Town, the Oxford Arms. Yeah, and the very defiant Mayo crest still there on the side of the pub.
Still saying Chris Lynn at the bottom, despite all the evidence being to the contrary, that there hasn't been any kind of divine intervention on their side for so long. An odd part of the story of Fairy Tale is that a lot of people might know this, that its writer was born on Christmas Day, and he was more unique in more ways than in Britain at the time.
That's amazing, isn't it, that Shane McGowan was born on Christmas Day 1957 in Kent, but maintained a really strong connection to Tipperary right throughout his childhood, the Tipperary of his mother. And what's really interesting about Shane, I think, it's a society where so many second-generation Irish talent kind of hid their ethnicity behind stage names. So Mary O'Brien is Dusty Springfield. You know, George O'Dowd.
I never knew that.
Yeah, George O'Dowd is Boy George. Yeah. And Declan McManus becomes Elvis Costello.
Yeah. Not Costello. Costello.
Costello.
I never knew that about Dusty Springfield.
Yeah,
her name is Mary O'Brien.
Yeah. And Sean Campbell wrote the great book on second-generation Irish musicians. That's where that comes from. But McGowan was the exception to this kind of common rule. You know, he wore his Irishness as a badge of honour. And when he first emerges in the city's kind of thriving punk scene, part of a band called The Nips, it wasn't long before, and that wasn't their full name, by the way, but we're not saying their full name on the on the radio this
Thank
early.
You, yeah.
It wasn't long before the foundation of the Pogues. And I love that the Pogues go on this kind of weird journey where they're trying to figure out what they are. Mm. So before the name, there's the New Republicans, which is a great name. It's kind of wind up on the New Romantics, who are very much in trend at the time. And of an early gig, Shane remembered how we were pelted off stage, but a lot of people were interested. The man who owned the place, bless him, was Irish. He pulled the plug after six songs for our safety and the club's reputation. He said, "Great show, lads. Never come here again."
Very good, which is about as good a write-up as you'd ever want. Like, this is brilliant, and I never want you to try and replicate this at any time in history. The band, of course, and as we all know, and this is what they're so famed for, that they were able to fuse this kind of Irish-born talent with diaspora members, and it meant that the sound that they came up with was quite unique.
Yeah, that's exactly what makes the Pogues. It's the nucleus of second-generation Irish and Irish-born musicians. So they bring in people who are very, very respected in Irish music. Terry Woods, who'd been in the great band Sweeney's Men, and the Dubliner Philip Ryan, better recalled as Philip Chevron. These are very respected figures in the Irish music scene. But at the heart of the band is the London talent. You know, it's people like Spider Stacey, it's people like Shane McGowan and Cato Reardon. And the band had a very kind of distinct look. They nearly look like a show band of the 1950s or like Irish labourers. Mm. So they're wearing the black suits, the white shirts, but no tie, you know, yeah. The top button open. It's a very distinctive look. And they're just full of nods to the past, but they also have this great youthfulness. It's kind of like the 1950s meets the year of punk, 79, yeah. And this is what falls out. And I think most importantly, they're a really defiant thing, not only in the UK. You know, Chevron, years later, was talking about it wasn't just the no dogs, no blacks, no Irish mantra that we were challenging, but also the idea at home, back in Ireland, you know, the idea that these people were plastic paddies.
Yeah.
So it was two fingers, I suppose, in very different directions.
Yeah, it's kind of real authenticity to it as well. When the first album does drop, there's this kind of cliched album cover, but then it also opens with the first song that does really almost set out a manifesto for the band, what it's all about.
Red Roses, for me, it's a great album, and the album cover depicts our kind of young protagonists before a picture of John F. Kennedy, which was a familiar...
It was a picture that was in pretty much every Irish household at the time.
Exactly,
yeah.
A familiar staple in many Irish homes. But when you listen to the first track on that album, Trans Metropolitan, it owes nothing to Ireland and it owes absolutely everything to London. And probably the only verse that you could read out on the radio from a £5 bet in William Hills.
Hang on, you've got the full verse here written down in your notes and there's bits of it that I'm not sure you probably could read out. But look, we are what we are. We're in for a penny, in for a pound. So go
let's get the next line. From a fried egg in Valtaros to a Tottenham Court Road ice cream, we'll spew and lurch, get nicked and fixed on the way, we'll kill and maim. When you haven't got a penny, boys, it's all the bloody same. But that just maps out London, that song, you know, verse by verse. A London that in some ways is gone and parts of which still exist. And there are places that meant very little here, but, you know, everything there.
Yeah.
And that was 1984.
There is a line in that verse about Soho, which is a little bit less safe for work than the rainy night that they sing about in future times. Soon afterwards then comes the process of beginning a Christmas song. And what's amazing about it is that they're singing a Christmas song and even trying to conceive it about a city that none of them have ever been to.
1985, this process begins. And it's more than 2 years before the song is finished. And as Jem remembered, for a band like the Pogues, we were very strongly rooted in all kinds of traditions rather than the present. It was a no-brainer, the idea of doing a Christmas song. And kind of lying around the band's recording space was a copy of A Fairy Tale of New York, which is an acclaimed novel by J.P. Dunleavy. So that inspires the title. But McGowan had never actually been to New York at the time the song was written, or at least the beginning of when they were writing it. But they fall in love with the idea of New York, even though they haven't been there.
So yes,
there's a romanticised New York that is later a recurring character in a lot of Pogues' work. Thousands Are Sailing talks about Times Square, the lights of Broadway, all of that. I think if you actually dissect the lyrics of Fairy Tale, there's some humour at play. Like the NYPD choir, for example.
Yeah, doesn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah. The police department in New York don't have a choir. They have a pipe and drums band. So the choir, I've always wondered, could the boys in the drunk tank themselves, are they the NYPD choir? Are the suspected criminals and the down and outs in the police station rather than the police themselves, the boys of the NYPD choir?
When they first record the track, or when they at least lay down their first demo of it, of course, it's not Kirsty MacColl who's doing the female vocals. It's Cato Reardon herself. And as we'll hear when we play a demo in just a few minutes' time, it doesn't make the cut.
No, it's a totally different song in some ways. The tempo of it is different. Lyrically, you can find some of the similarities in it, but it's a different song. But it's the genesis of what becomes Fairy Tale of New York. And Cato Reardon performs a duet with McGowan. And at the time, they're recording an EP, Pogetry in Motion, with Elvis Costello.
Pogetry in Motion, sorry.
It's a great work of art. Rainy Night in Soho is on it. Planxty Noel Hill, which is the traditional music equivalent of a hip-hop diss track, because Noel Hill was one of Ireland's great traditional, still is one of Ireland's great traditional musicians and a brilliant concertina player.
Gets a name check in Liszt in Varna. So you have to be good if that's the level you're at. Yeah.
Absolutely. Noel is a wonderful, wonderful musician, a great teacher of music. But he'd been famously dismissive of the Pogues' musical output. He described it as a terrible abortion, which is as bad a review as any band can ever hope for.
Yeah.
So naming a tune after him, Planxty Knoll Hill, was a form of playful revenge. So forget the West Coast, East Coast stuff. That was a diss track.
There is a little bit of the original demo with Culture Reardon, which is available on YouTube. Let's have a quick listen. It's a totally different song. Don't listen to it. Like, what you're hearing there, like, it's so far removed from the version that we know that it's just totally different. Different soul.
Yeah, you can hear what would become the masterpiece of Fairy Tale of New York within it, just about. And, you know, the band clearly felt that it had a potential future, but then that future is in massive jeopardy because Cotto Reardon is kind of romantically involved with Elvis Costello. She leaves the band, and when McGowan records the next demo of it, he's singing both the male and female parts. They don't really
that's
know.
That's a demo that I want to hear. If that one is on YouTube, I want to hear that one somewhere.
What's going to happen with this song? So. Yeah. A degree of every great story is luck, isn't it? And when the new producer, Steve Lillywhite, brings this song back to his home studio and keeps working on it, his wife, none other than the great pop singer Kirsty MacColl, lays down a kind of audio recording which just transfixes the Pogues.
Okay.
And they say, right, that's it, that's what we want. And as Shane put it, Kirsty knew exactly the right measure of viciousness and femininity and romance to put into it. And she had a very strong character, and it came across in a big way.
Yeah. And so it's just by total fluke.
Pretty much by fluke, yeah. Wow. And when you think about who Kirsty MacColl is, it makes it even nicer. She's the daughter of Ewan MacColl, the folk collector, the architect of the British folk revival. And then you have a band who took kind of something of the Irish folk revival, but did their own thing with it too.
Yeah.
They're both products of something something very different from what they ultimately produce.
Yeah. Now, the song is obviously not without its controversies lyrically, and this has been something which has been a bit of a hot potato for the last couple of years, but the band do, historically at least, defend some of the language that's used in it.
I think if we want to understand Fairy Tale of New York, we have to see it as a theatrical work. It's like it's like the pantomime. It's being performed in front of you.
Mm.
And beyond punk rock and Irish trad, there were all kinds of big influences over the Pogues, but one of them, Philip Chevron especially, was very influenced by kind of Agnes Barnell, by cabaret, by theatre. And I think there is something deeply theatrical about Fairy Tale. And one of the controversies, as you mentioned, regards lyrics, is the use of that homophobic slur. But McGowan was adamant that we should see the words as coming from these invented characters, not from the band,
so,
not from the mouth of Kirsty.
It's not my words, it's the words of this person on
exactly.
a stage.
This is how a down and out in the streets of New York speaks. And he says, look, the word was used by the character because it fitted with the way she would speak and with the character. She's not supposed to be a nice person or even a wholesome person. That's worth saying. Philip Chevron from the Pogues was himself a gay man and performed this song many thousands of times. But it does remain a minor controversy. You can kind of, you know, you can set your watch to it really every Christmas.
So we're talking now 34 or 35 years on, and yet it is still a staple of the airwaves. It still probably charts every year based on streaming plays. Why does it survive?
That's a great question. I think it survives because it has real emotional power, and you can grow tired of it, and we all do every year. You go tired of hearing it for a while.
Yeah, there's the Fairy Tale Challenge. Do you know that one where people try to get through the whole month of December without hearing it? It's like, do you remember the old thing about the game? If you remember you've played the game, then you've lost the game. We have to tell people, sorry everyone, you've just lost the game. But it's this thing that people try to get through all of December without hearing it once.
And you won't, because they'll be playing it in the Rover's Return on Coronation Street or something. You know, you'll hear it in a shopping centre, so it's impossible.
It's the backing track to the Aldi ads, I think, this Christmas. Yeah.
And when we take a break from it, and we go back to it and we listen to it with fresh ears, you know, for the first time of the year or whatever, we just hear something in it. And when you play another version, like Christy Moore's version, you know, someone who's been very open and frank of his own time and in the Drunk Tank, you hear the emotion, the hope and the despair in it again. And I think another reason for its enduring appeal is of course the tragedy of Kirsty's death, just 41 years of age. So it's become a part of her enduring legacy. And if anyone's ever in Soho Square, any listeners when you're in London, there's a lovely bench tour in Soho Square with her lyrics on it, but I think she lives eternally in Fairy Tale too. So look, on another level, it's endured because the Pogues themselves split up many, many times and return triumphantly into each other's arms again. There's always that hope of another better year. And I think we might like Fairy Tale because the voices that we hear on it, they sound genuine. You know, they sound like they've lived it, and that's what makes it.
Even if they'd never actually been to New York. Donal Fallon, you'll be back next week, so we'll talk to you again on our St. Stephen's Day episode. But before then, thank you for coming in. Thank you for this and all of your other moments of inspiration and illumination all year. Happy Christmas to you and all of yours. Donald's book, Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, is available in all good bookshops. It will probably make a really good Christmas gift, plug, for somebody in your life. He's also the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast, which you'll find anywhere online.
On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.